Hello, welcome to Agalia Chats. I'm Eric Meyer. I'm a developer advocate at Agalia.
And I'm Mujwa, and I'm a developer advocate at Agalia.
And we have a guest today. Guest, please introduce yourself and tell people what it is you do.
Hi, I'm Lynn Fisher. I am a web designer. I work for a little company called Fireship, where we create YouTube videos, a newsletter, and developer courses. And you might know me from a bunch of weird websites that I make and maintain and love to explore the powers of CSS and things like that.
Yeah, and that's why we wanted to talk to you, because you do have these, I mean, you said that they were weird little websites. I think they're awesome little websites, but
thank
then
you.
Part of that is that, first of all, they're awesome, but second of all, I think like you, I come from the tradition of the weird web. Right. When the web was sort of starting out and we were just doing whatever.
Yep.
And yeah, so you've been, how long have you been at that?
Gosh, I mean, I was kind of learning how to make websites around the GeoCities, MySpace, LiveJournal era.
Nice.
I've been doing websites professionally since about 2007.
Yeah, but professional, I'm just talking web in general. So
okay. Yeah. Just, around the like early 2000s.
Yeah. Turn of the millennium stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, you build all this stuff. Like, why?
I don't know. I think when I discovered that you can make websites, I think, you know, kind of just a little spark happened in me. I think the coolest thing about the web, why I like to make websites, like why it's kind of like my medium of choice, is that you can really easily share it with other people. I think that's really the clincher there, where, I mean, you can share art in a lot of different ways, but I think at the scale that's possible with websites, there's nothing that compares to it. So yeah, I think the web is an interesting medium to create kind of these document style sites, to create interactive art pieces. It's very interesting to me, and I think all the ideas that kind of run through my head kind of channel through the medium of the web.
Yeah. One thing that people may have come across you for that they don't realize it is a single div. It's kind of would you agree it's sort of the site that made you internet famous?
Yeah. I think that was the first time anything I made really kind of broke through my little circle of influence.
Right.
So that was really cool. But yeah, that was a about 10-year project that I worked on it, where I created just illustrations out of CSS using just one div per illustration. And yeah, it's a fun little project. I still feel really fondly about it.
Yeah, I would imagine. Some of them were, wow, mind-blowing. But you say a single div. I'm assuming that you were not canvassing into the divs.
No, yeah, just a regular HTML div and whatever CSS was available at whatever time I was doing the illustration. And yeah, I think at the time when I was starting that project, CSS illustration was definitely happening. The thing I really remember was someone drew, I don't know names at this point, but someone drew all the Simpsons characters in CSS, mm-hmm. and it was just incredible. It was perfect. But each Simpsons character was made of about 40 divs, right? And so people, of course, would point to that and say, see, this isn't practical. It's so much bloat, which is quaint. At the time, we were worried about that. and so I was kind of looking into it like, well, you know, right now, at the time, we were putting icons on a site with a div or sometimes two, depending on what we needed to do. And so I was like, oh, maybe, what if the CSS illustrations were just that, like the markup was really clean and minimal, like then would it be okay? You know, just kind of thinking about it through that argument. And it was cool. Once I started doing it, I thought it was nice because it adds this really kind of tight constraint to the project. And so you, each illustration, you really do have to kind of think creatively. You have to look into CSS properties maybe that you wouldn't normally use for something. A lot of it was, you know, hand nudging, testing things out. And so, it was a cool learning experience for sure. Just trying to achieve something with such tight constraints.
What did you lean on the most for that? I'm just curious.
Definitely background image, linear gradients. and radial gradients, and then later on in the project, conic gradients. Those to me are the most impactful in that type of exercise. And actually, when I was starting early on, background size actually wasn't super widely supported. And so then it was really an exercise in layering. You know, like, I think that it was a little bit trickier. But once background size really hit, I think kind of the sky's the limit in terms of what you can create with just background image.
Okay. Why was that such a game changer?
Well, because before background size, the gradient would take up like 100% width and height of the div. And so you really had to think about, like, it would be hard to make different shapes and place them within the div, like within the background, kind of, if you think of it like a canvas. And so what I'd end up having to do is create gradients that would go like some color and then a bunch of transparency and then layer them on top of each other. Whereas now with background size, you can say, oh, this one's, you know, 10 pixels by 10 pixels, and I want it at 10 pixels, 10 pixels left and top or something, and it'll just stick there. And you don't have to worry so much about what's sitting behind it or on top of it.
Okay. I guess you could design a component of the image at full size and then be like, okay, now that I figured out all those details, I'm going to shrink you down and put you over here.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. With linear gradient, you can create like rectangles and triangle type shapes. And then with radial and conic gradient, you can create diamonds and circles. And so you kind of have all the shapes available to you now, that where you can kind of just be placing them anywhere in your illustration. So yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like CSS in the web at large is such a, how do I say it, like, underappreciated and niche platform, I guess, because it's like more utilized for, let's say, less weird means. But it's refreshing, and just going through like some of them, my favorite is the chili garlic sauce. I'm biased because it's like, it has so many things going for it, but it's amazing. And I can't believe that we're still not exploring like the web in more artistic ways. Like, most of the mainstream web is, I wouldn't say minimalistic, because it's just like, it feels boring at some point. And I wonder, like, if we can rewild the web somehow.
Yeah, that's interesting where, timeline-wise, when all of these really powerful CSS properties were giving us kind of this like artistic toolkit, the trends of the websites really kind of weren't utilizing them. We shifted to more flat color. We shifted to really minimalist layouts. And even now, I think a lot of the more corporate websites all kind of have this minimalist style. So I am really looking forward to kind of a, not skeuomorphism, but a renaissance of texture and color, and, you know, bringing in a little bit more of the things that we were playing with in the earlier days, and that CSS makes super easy now. We're really lucky. I feel like, you know, rounded corners back in the day, we always joke how hard it was to do that. And now it's just no big deal at all.
Yeah. So how many single divs were there?
Do you remember? Oh, you know, I don't know that. I should look and see. Quite a lot. It was all on one page for a long time, and I ended up splitting it into two just for page loading, and so you didn't have to scroll quite as far. But the last few years of the project, I did Divtober, which was a kind of a play on Inktober, where a handful of us would do single divs every day in October. So that really bumped up the number, because before I was just kind of doing it whenever I had time or was inspiration struck. So doing it once a day was another challenge of really keeping the drawings short to a timeline too, where it's like, okay, I'll spend an hour or two on this and then I'm done. Where other ones in the past, I had kind of put it down for a while, come back to it, you know, when you have the leisure of time to work on it.
What interests me sometimes about when I go through a single div is that sometimes there are ones that I'll go past, and at first they'll seem very simple, and then I realize, wait a minute, I have some idea. I don't know. I have some idea what had to go into making that. And wow. Just wow. The DVD screensaver would be an example.
Oh, yeah.
Right? where it bounces around the screen and it changes colors just like the old DVD screensaver used to do. And that seems real simple, real normal. But then it's like, wait, this is just one div.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I think when you incorporate animation, that limits you even more, where really there's the before and after are the ones that you can animate. Because if you're animating the div, it's going to animate everything, which I think there actually is one where I had to do that. Or no, probably not animation. I think with transforms, like if you're rotating something, if you rotate the div, it's going to rotate the before and after. And so you have to unrotate those elements. Like, I think there's some tricks like that where you have to be a little bit careful about what is the thing that you're transforming or animating. But yeah, animation is a fun challenge there where you want the animation to loop always. And so there's kind of, I don't know, an interesting challenge of making it seem, I guess you're trying to make the animation fluid and as though it's not some sort of a hack that you're doing on the div.
Yeah, one of my other favorites, even though it's not very complicated, is The Moon's Haunted.
Oh, yeah. I love that one.
Right next to the 11T possum. But
oh, yeah. The possum.
Yeah.
That was fun.
The awesome opossum. But yeah.
Yeah.
Just every time I see that with the ghosts orbiting around.
Yeah.
The moon, like Moon's Haunted.
Moon's Haunted.
Nice.
Yeah. That's what's fun, too, about in Divtober, you're working from a prompt every day, like just a random word. And so I feel like there was a lot of, okay, when you think of ghost or whatever, it probably was ghost. Like, what is the first thing you think of? And I thought the first thing I think of is Moon's Haunted, you know? So like, yeah, that was a fun one.
So you did that for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I assume that other projects were coming up while you were doing that as well.
Yeah, around 2014, 2015 is when kind of a lot of these projects started manifesting in my backlog, I guess. And so I was working on YAZ is a little website that I worked on at an agency I was working at at the time, but it's a little just Reasons to Love Arizona website. And the illustrations on that site are all single div CSS illustrations. That's kind of first where I started kind of playing around with that. And then the next one, I was working on Airport Codes, which broke containment into the aviation community, which was pretty cool. A lot of airport nerds out there I got to chat with. So since Airport Codes, I've had a new project, you know, every 1 or 2 years that I've been focusing on. Up until recently, I've really been focusing on my project Nestflix. If you've seen that, it's a little fake streaming website. And that one has, because of the breadth of the data that's involved in that site, I've been working on it off and on for about almost 5 years now. It's about 4.5 years. Yeah.
And so Nestflix, it sounds like it's movies about birds to me.
Yeah, I actually, the bird community comments on it quite a bit too, because they do have, like, they call bird cams Nestflix.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Nestflix is essentially it's a glorified wiki, really, of fake movies that appear in other movies. So the one I always reference that people know is in Home Alone, Kevin watches that black and white gangster movie, Angels with Filthy Souls. And that movie is totally fictional. It only appears in that movie. And so Nestflix, it's a pretend streaming service, but it catalogs all of those like fake movies and fake shows that show up in other movies and shows.
Okay. Is that restricted to things that are off to one side, or does it also have entries for, I'm thinking like the studio, the series, the studio where they're making either movies or shows. And so you spend a lot of time on them, or, what was it? The Aaron Sorkin one, Newsnight, which is all about a show that doesn't actually exist in the real world.
Right. Yeah. So all of those do qualify. I actually have been waiting to do some of the Aaron Sorkin ones, because some of the series aren't streaming. I'm a little bit limited to what I'm able to access, to watch and capture. My main criteria is that it's fictional, and that it shows some footage. So like the studio is good, where most of them, they either have a fake trailer or it shows them shooting part of the movie. And they also create, I'd love to get my hands on this kind of, material, but they also, the designers on the TV show have created fake posters that they walk by and fake ads on TV and things like that. So yeah, those ones are great.
Yeah. So, but it has to have some kind of video component, I guess.
Yeah. Footage would be ideal. I will allow, if they're filming, they're in the process of filming it, if there's like decent footage for that. And the exception is for some movies, they'll have movie posters only, but there's a lot of them. So in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Lucas Lee, played by Chris Evans, is an action actor. And so they quickly show like 5 of his movie posters in succession. So then I can compile those and make like a Lucas Lee collection, or Tracy Jordan on 30 Rock, things like that. Or in 21 Jump Street, they show a bunch of fake sequels to 22 Jump Street, 23 and a half Jump Street. I don't know what they actually are, but those ones I'm able to put on the site because I can kind of lump them together and make an entry that way.
I imagine that The Simpsons would be a source of so many.
Yeah, I actually, in my spreadsheet, I have a whole sheet that's dedicated just to The Simpsons because there's so many. And I went through, when I initially did the site, I felt like I was doing so many Simpsons entries. And I still have probably like 300 in a spreadsheet that I haven't added to the site. So I'm not, everything is going to get added, of course. Like I just don't have, I won't be able to do it, I think. But yeah, there's tons in The Simpsons. It's a great one for Nestedflix.
And speaking of breaking containment, Nestedflix kind of broke containment recently, didn't it?
Yeah, that one was wild. So when I released it, kind of my normal circle of web friends were like, great, cool. And then I went grocery shopping and my phone just started blowing up and Patton Oswalt actually tweeted about it. And so it hit movie Twitter, which was actually really cool.
Yeah.
So I talked with Entertainment Weekly. There was, they featured the project. And so I think it hit kind of a movie audience that got really into it and tons of people. The cool thing about most of my projects is that I ask for contributions. I want people to contribute to the project. And so after that, tons of people were submitting titles that I didn't have on the site yet. And so I have a big spreadsheet of all those, and I've been slowly adding to the site over the years. So yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, and weren't you in the BBC, The Guardian, something recently?
Oh, yeah, yep. Yeah, it was really wild. It's just an interesting topic. And recently it popped up back up again because of Christmas time and Home Alone. Everyone's already watching Home Alone. And so people were writing about the fake movie in that.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed that they remake The Last Action Hero. Because
yes.
Then you'll be
set. I think they easily could.
So I assume that starts with some kind of itch in your head, right? I have to assume that you didn't just sit down one day and say, what kind of a meta website could I make?
Yeah. No, I think a lot of them, like Airport Codes, especially, and Nestflix, they kind of start as that's kind of a cool thing to notice, right? Like Airport Codes, like the way I described it to people is that, you know, sometimes the code, the 3-letter code doesn't match the city or the airport name. And so like, what is that? And so there's this kind of breadth of history that exists about all of these airport codes and like why they're specific names. So I'm like, that's like, once you notice that, that's kind of just a cool thing to know and to see. And same with the fake movies, where I think everyone probably remembers now when they found out that that Home Alone movie was fake, that it's not real. It's a kind of like your eyes are opened to this like this thing that exists in the world. And so you're kind of looking for it now. So it usually starts kind of just as an idea, something I'm interested in, something that's cool. And then I'll go online and look around, like there's gotta be a list somewhere of all these, right? And usually there are just scattered, they're incomplete. And they're just wikis or, text-based, right? And so I'm a visual person. And so I think like, how can we create a more comprehensive database or wiki about this? And then also like, how could it be presented in a way that's like visual and fun to interact with. And so that's kind of how it evolves into a web project. And those ones, I think one thing I like about these projects too, is I think I'm a bit of an archivist too. Like I really enjoy the process of like, okay, now I got to just like find all this information and like bring it all together. I think that's a really fun process. And it's good that I like it because it's a lot of the work, you know? But yeah, and that's kind of how it grows. And then with a project like Nestflix, I think one way that it was sitting in my backlog for a long time. And I think the thing that helped me realize it into a real project is I was like, how would you present this information in a way that's fun or interesting? And I was like, it should be like a fake streaming service where you could it feels even more meta that it like, you know, mimics some interface that you're really familiar with, or like, oh man, I wish I could watch this movie, but I, you know. So yeah, that's really how those projects kind of grow into reality.
In keeping with the Hollywood theme, one of the other interesting ones that I saw was Hollywood Age Gap.
So that is a site. The idea behind that is it's so interesting that in Hollywood movies and TV shows, very regularly the love interest ages are, I feel like on average, like this is just me off the cuff, like I feel like 10 years is normal for the man to be about 10 years older than the woman. And then there's like extreme examples, like if you think about movies like James Bond, where James Bond is 20, 30 years older than the love interest in that particular film. And so I thought that that was really interesting. Also, this is like could be an offshoot of this site, but where women are cast as a man's mother, but she's like just not old enough to be his mother. She's like 11 years older than him, you know? So I just find that, I think that's an interesting trend. I was looking around, like, where is there a place that, there were a lot of articles that would kind of point out the most egregious examples or would call out actors who have this kind of recurring problem or like Tom Cruise and Adam Sandler and people like that, they were called out. There was actually a great article on that, but I was like, there's got to be a way that we can catalog this in a more complete way. And so that's where the site came from. It's actually one of the sites that really helps connect me to the DataViz community online, where basically all I'm tracking, the site is kind of a grid, but what the main data that I'm tracking is the actors who are in the film, like when the film was made, the director, and the like each of their birthdays. So it calculates the age gap when that movie was made. But it outputs a data file, and actually lots of DataViz folks have like pulled that data and used it to create. I'm not a charts and graphs person. That's just not a skill set that I've honed very well. So it's cool to see these DataViz experts kind of graphing the data and, you know, changing how you can kind of visualize the differences. It's pretty cool.
So the data that's being visualized here is at the time that the movie was made. So Jurassic Park, 1993. I happen to be looking at it. Sam Neill and Laura Dern are playing, the paleontologists who also have a relationship. You have the ages of the actual actors.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the ages that are in universe.
No, right. The characters. Right. Yeah. Quote, unquote. Just the age of the actors.
Okay.
At the time of the film being made.
Yep. Right. Which, I mean, in a lot of cases, like pretty much any Woody Allen movie, there.
Yes.
That's. Yep. They're probably even more of an age gap in those situations in universe. But yeah, right. And it's part of the reason that I wanted to mention this is that the top, like the number one biggest age gap is in Harold and Maude. Bud Cort actually just, as we're recording this, died, I think, yesterday or the day before, who played the Harold, who was at the time, the actor was 23. And the Ruth Gordon who played Maude, according to the site here, was 75.
Yeah. So
there was a 52-year age. Of course, that's the whole point of the movie is that.
Right. In that similar vein, when there is a decent age gap and the woman is older, it tends to be a plot point that it's a relationship between an older woman and a younger man versus the other way where the man is older. It's just kind of, it's not really pointed out. Unless it's a really extreme.
Yeah, usually probably not pointed out. Again, in a few cases.
Yes, it is. Yeah, definitely.
Well, in some cases, it's going to be a plot point like Harold and Maude, for example.
Right.
But, how many of them are the other way around?
There are a decent amount, but not not a lot, not many, especially mm-hmm. as a percentage. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that I've noticed over time, lately with newer movies, I'm finding fewer and fewer good examples to add to the site, which is, I think, good, probably, that the casting has changed, the way that people want to see relationships on screen has changed. But I'm finding it's much closer now. Love interests are much closer in age now than they used to be. And so I don't add as many anymore. so a lot, or if I do, a lot of them are movies from the past. So I think, I don't know if I ever added this. I it's definitely an issue to be added, but to add just like a toggle where you can show only the ones where the woman is older or vice versa, mm. or
have a few filters.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
So I went down to the bottom of the page and some of these had, there's 0 years. Mm-hmm. Did you include those because you didn't want to have just one end of the distribution?
Right. Or yeah, I think it would be good to show popular movies where that there just isn't that age gap. Mm-hmm. And as I was initially doing the kind of initial dump, I was going through by actor and actresses, kind of just doing their whole catalog. And so I would just add them. And sometimes they would just naturally be on the lower end of the of the spectrum. So,
okay. So that's two things that are Hollywood related, but you also did Airport Codes. I'm assuming that Hollywood is just.
Yeah. I just am a movie and TV watcher. I love that. And there just naturally tends to be a lot of trivia or trends and those types of things. So I do have a couple, I guess I have a project called Dress David Rose, where David Rose from Schitt's Creek, Dan Levy, he has just a very unique style in that show. And so on that side, I catalog every shirt and sweater he wears on the show. So that was a little bit of a research, like collection, data collection site, but also an illustration project for me. Those are all SVG. I did that illustration and that would be wild in CSS. So it was just, I was working in Illustrator, but so that's a fun project. And then I also have, The Good Place, the Kristen Bell, Ted Danson, Mike Schur show. That's a show where food is kind of a big, like mentioned a lot and shown a lot throughout the show. And so I collected all that data every time anyone talked about food or beverages, and created a fake restaurant menu that catalogs all of the food items from that show. So yeah, when I get into a show or a movie series or something, I think I'll typically notice some of these recurring themes or recurring jokes. And those are kind of ripe for building a site around.
I feel like it also probably calls for a certain amount of, let's say, completionist tendencies.
For sure. I was actually thinking about this today. A project I'm working on right now is I'm trying to catalog all the concerts I've been to in my lifetime, which has been interesting because a lot of them were when I was in high school. And so there's like very little record of shows like that on the internet. And so I was feeling kind of an overwhelmed feeling, but also like an excited feeling about collecting all this data and being able to have it be comprehensive. And so, yeah, I think that is a little bit of a driver for me is like, hey, there's all this scattered data somewhere and I'm gonna put it all together and it's going to be this perfect little archive.
How much do you rely on Wikipedia in those cases? I'm just curious.
I do a lot for the age gap one, especially things like birthdays. I feel like for more informational type things. So on Netflix, like the studios that were involved with making each of the seasons of shows, for making sure I'm like crediting the right people. And I'm sure I've gotten a lot of it wrong, but I really earnestly try to make sure that I have like the right credits. And on my I have a website about Top Chef. So I use Wikipedia for that, for contestants, and they do some like episode recaps that help me out. So yeah, I think I haven't used it much on my concert site. I think the data is just very scattered. But I never in earnest gave it a try to try and figure out if I could compile this data. But yeah, I think I can. And so I think I will.
all of them are so high quality. You're such a great artist, but I'm personally so impressed by the US flags. And I mean, obviously, like, it's such a great concept and idea, and like, it's beautifully done. But yeah, like, being part of the a few, at least, flag nerd communities and knowing a bunch of people. Like, I know that you're particularly interested in the U.S. because you're based in the U.S., but I think, like, no shade on U.S. states, but, like, there's other flags that are really cool as well. And, like, I think you've inspired me to try something, maybe with, like, Spanish regional flags or something, like, some cool flags.
Yeah, that would be awesome. You should totally do that. And I agree that there's much better flags outside of the U.S. A lot of the state flags are just the state seal on blue, usually. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of states. Arizona has a very good flag. So yeah. I love that one. But yeah, it's been interesting. That one was interesting where I was trying to catalog flag design, like specifically about the designs of the flags, like official colors and dimensions and things like that, which it's, I actually reached out to a lot of state governments to try and get information, and a lot of them don't have it, which is also interesting. You know, we talk about how companies don't have good design systems and things, and I think governments of states could use some help too. But it's also been fun. I have liked, especially, like, some states' flags have been redesigned recently better, and that's been cool too.
I love these redesigns as well. And always, like, when they organize these contests, like, the submissions are so cool. Sometimes I wish they be better. But yeah, like, it's such a nice way to learn about flags while, like, just nerding out. And yeah, it's a beautifully designed site. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to agree with you about Arizona's flag. And it's kind of amazing to me that it is the original flag.
Mm-hmm.
Because it looks like one of these recent redesigns.
Right, right. You know? Really bold and graphic. And
right. It doesn't have like those real fiddly like details that you see in state seals, that sort of thing. It's just like, here are 16 geometric forms. That's it.
Yes. Roman Mars, I think, did a podcast episode on state flags. Or I think it was more just the design of flags, like what makes a good design. And I remember one was like that you could probably draw it by hand. Right. And so, like, some of those state seal ones are definitely not hitting that requirement.
Right. I'm going to admit to a slight bit of pride. I come from, I live in the only state that does not have a rectangular flag.
Oh, that's a,
Yep. Ohio has a swallow-tailed burgee shape.
I do love that.
I mean, it's interesting. So cool.
Yeah. Unique for sure.
I'm actually curious about something. Since airport codes has kind of come up before. But on the airport code site, you have all these airport codes that are backed by very nice photography.
Yes.
Where did you get all that photography from? Because it's a lot of airports literally all over the world.
Yeah. So it is a combination of like the Wikimedia Commons and Flickr, where the images are Creative Commons licensed.
Okay.
So yeah, it was, there is actually, I think, aviation photography and airport photography is a little community industry of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a lot to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I'm at the point now where the ones that are yet to be added are the ones that don't have great photography. Like they're just less visited, or I just, all the photos are copyrighted. And so I can't use those. Or I'll reach out to the airport and they won't write me back or things like that. And so, but yeah, I was able to, I mean, thousands of airports before I kind of ran into that issue of not having something to show.
Yeah, I just clicked into one and discovered that the credit was to somebody that I knew.
What? Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's the awesome. Picture for Pearson International Airport in Toronto. It was taken by Coralie Mercier, who is at the W3C.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's very cool. So is that, you know, Wikimedia Commons, is that a thing that you draw on a lot in some of these, or?
I guess for airport codes especially, and the flags where there's just the public domain, like SVGs I can use and things like that. But I'm trying to think. I think I actually was hoping there would be more for this concerts project I've been working on. But I think there hasn't been as many concert photos on there. But yeah, I think for airport codes especially, it was very, very helpful.
some of the other ones look like maybe you found a clip art source, but did you make the clip art? So as an example, the dusting zone.
Oh, yeah, the dusting zone. That, I think that was a design asset. What's that place? Oh, Creative Market. Hmm. I think that one was from there.
Okay.
Yeah, the dusting zone. That was a Netlify hack day kind of a project.
And what's the point of the dusting zone?
Yeah, so the prompt for that event was dusty domains, and it was, hey, build a site for those domains you're like sitting on for years, you're not using them. Like, it's finally time to make a site and deploy it, right? Deploy it on Netlify or whatever. And so I am actually very disciplined with my domain buying, so I don't buy a domain until a project's about 75% done. So I didn't have any dusty domains, but I decided I want to do one anyway. So I kind of ran with the like dusty theme, and the site is, it's almost just a, hey, stop here if you're feeling stressed and you need a little break. And so there's a blackboard or a whiteboard on there with some illustrations like you're mentioning, and you can just erase it and then refresh it, erase it. And I think there's something a little bit satisfying about that, like just being clearing the board, you know, like it's like those pressure washing videos that you can watch. It's like, oh, this is nice. You can like clean it.
I was just thinking I would assume you were just a little bit ahead of the power washing simulator vibe, like the whole dadcore video game.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just, it feels just satisfying to do that.
I think what makes it really satisfying is that, you can get it right. Cause I don't know about you, but when I clean things off in the real world, they're never completely clean.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I clean off my laptop screen or whatever. There's still a little bit of smudge. It's just like, But here,
totally.
As long as I make sure that I touch every pixel,
it's
all clean.
100%.
So which of these would you say is your favorite?
Oh, wow. Gosh, I don't know. I think probably a single div, just because I spent so long with it, and I think it pushed me in a point in my career where I really needed that, right? I think it was really helpful in me growing and also like connecting with people in the community. I think that project especially like just put my work in front of people that I wanted to learn from and be connected with and chat CSS with, you know? And so that was probably my favorite in that way. Besides that, I would say Nestflix is a huge one. That one, I think I look at it and I'm like, I still think this is like so fun and cool, you know? And also when I'm working on these projects with all this data, that one actually is a lot of data collection and then also a lot of asset generation. So like I create, every entry has, it's a logo and it's in SVG. And so I have to either figure out how to make that either by hand or by using Adobe Illustrator tools, right? Like image trace and things like that. And so there was just a lot of work put into it. I sometimes, like when I'm in it, I'm like, I must have been in a trance. Like, how did I create all this stuff? And so it's fun to look at that and see the breadth of the content on that site. And it's a site I like looking at. And so I like that one a lot.
What about you, Joel? What was your favorite in here?
I think it has to be the Flex, because it's so cool. I also like that the YAZ, just like I've never been to Arizona, but I can feel your enthusiasm through this website.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that project's definitely a passion project where it's probably the site. So .az is Azerbaijan, the country code. And so it's not a cheap domain. So it's like, I joke that it's my project with the like biggest differential between like visitors and domain cost. I've heard that people that I know, especially in Arizona, when they're trying to recruit people and people are not super jazzed on Arizona, they could send them that and be like, hey, there's some cool stuff here. So,
yeah. Okay. I'm going to go with open source, open hearts.
Oh, that was a good one. So yeah, that's a project that I worked on at Netlify, and it's basically you can send little Valentine's themed cards to open source maintainers that you want to say thank you to or show your appreciation.
This is such good timing to remind people
about it. Oh, yeah.
We are doing this right before Valentine's Day. And then the other thing that I really want to hear about your, like, the way you can be creative on the web is your yearly site redesigns, which are always really involved. Well, they seem always really involved to me.
Yeah. This year's was probably the most simple one I've done lately, which was nice. I wasn't super stressed out about it. But yeah, I redesign my website every year. Lately, it's been around December. But yeah, so starting, probably like 2016, about 10 years ago, I really wanted to focus on exploring responsive design. And so like using it in ways that people don't expect, or doing some kind of like artistic stuff with the landing page of my website. Prior to that, it was a little bit more standard redesigns, kind of just changing colors and layout and things like that. But around that time, I really wanted to like push myself, and also, you know, CSS started to change real fast around that time. Like new stuff was coming out every year. And so there was always kind of a new CSS property or CSS theme or idea to explore when my redesign came up. So it has been really rewarding and fun, really trying to push myself each year and do something different and unexpected.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that certainly that I notice and a lot of people comment on is, at least with some of them, the way that as you change the viewport width, like things just change wildly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think coming back to like the web being a creative medium, I think one thing I wanted to explore was how people interact with the browser, like how that's such a unique aspect of the web, and how can you create something that uses that very specific thing. And so for years, I think people were doing that already with scroll, right? There was like that parallax boom there was, and people with GSAP, especially people doing cool animations on scroll, you know, sometimes they overdid it a little bit too much scroll jacking or whatever, but it was cool. Lots of people were doing really neat artistic things with scroll. And so I was like, what's another thing? And for web designers, it's resizing the browser, right? Like a lot of times you go to a site and the first thing you do is do that to see how the site is responsive, right? How did they handle this? Or sometimes there's just cool stuff. And so I really wanted to tap into that and say, okay, well, wouldn't it be fun? Like that first year, 2016, is the, what happens is as you resize the browser, every 100 pixels, it just totally changes the design of the site. There's about 20 something different layouts. And so what I wanted there was like for you to get to the site and you start resizing and it's like, whoa, what's happening, you know, to surprise you. Like, I don't think anyone is expecting something like that. And so that was really fun. And so that one, I was thinking about responsive in kind of a media query heavy way. And then other years I've thought about, okay, well, what if as you resize the browser becomes like an animation renderer, right? And so like there's a couple years where as you're resizing, like animation is happening, the site is changing, but only when you're resizing, right? It's like, that's the, like the trigger for the animation to happen. So I've also thought about like, oh, maybe the site, it looks boring, but then once you start resizing, then it's interesting, right? So then it's even more obscured. So some people might never see that, which is fine. You know, I'm like, you can experience it in different ways.
Right.
So just a lots to play with there.
Yeah, that first design that you talked about where it basically completely changes the design every 100 pixels or so. I find that fascinating almost from a Dadaist point of view, because two different people can have two profoundly different experiences of the same site just because their browser windows are a little bit different in size. And like literally could be you talking about, oh, did you see Lynn Fisher's site with the, it's got the thing over on the side, and then someone else goes to it and it's like, what are you talking about? There's
what?
That's not over there. There's shrimp on the left. No. And it's kind of challenging. Like a lot of the concepts that we rely on, like you're supposed to have a consistent user experience. And of course, I know that you would never say that Amazon should do this, for example, right? Or any site that's trying to sort of communicate information to a customer base, let's say.
Yeah.
But Yeah, it's another sort of aspect of the weirdness. And it's a thing that you can't really do in any other medium.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those fundamental things about the web, at least the web of now, that the only thing we're really using it for is to like move a piece over here so that things are, you know, they feel consistent, but things are arranged a little bit better depending on how people are coming in, which is great. That's an accessibility thing. Mm-hmm. But so often we just ignore the fact that, wow, you could do so much with this. You could do really bizarre things with this. But you had the insight to see that and do something with it.
Yeah, I think it came from, I'm usually a late adopter, but I feel like I was a real early adopter with responsive design at the company I was working at. I was like, we have to be doing this. And I think the two biggest things that I was trying to push or had to explain was one, that it's not just like media queries wasn't just about width, right? Mm-hmm. Like all these other things can change technically if we want to, right? And so like it could just be really anything, whatever we want to do. Of course, you would, like you were saying, like typically not do that with a client website or something. But the second thing was there was a lot of pushback about the site just like looking the same all the time, like no matter what device you're on, no matter what. And I think it took a lot for the industry and for people in general to, I think, kind of get and also to accept the idea that like, hey, things look a little bit different depending on the context of where you're seeing the site from, right? And that's okay. And so this takes this to the extreme, obviously, but like, I think there's this foundational concept of, yeah, this site is going to change depending on where it is. And I think that's a cool thing about the web, you know?
Yeah, like one thing that seems to recur in our discussions, like some of the biggest improvements that were made to the web platform or sort of some of the biggest technical restrictions being lifted was coinciding with a period where like culturally we were getting more and more restricted. And you were right, like if I think back to like learning about media queries and like what it means to build a responsive website, I'm pretty sure that nobody like in the mainstream was even talking about anything other than like width, which is like such a sad sort of limitation, which I mean, there's so much you can do with media queries, right? And it's only occurring to me for the first time today. It's like kind of sad, but yeah, we need you to teach people how to, you know, stop restricting themselves and use the medium.
Yeah, I think all the tools we use every day, especially in CSS, there's so much more that you can do with each thing than you even think about the like kind of typical application. And it's fun to just explore that. Like, yeah, media queries were so powerful even when they were first introduced. And now we have just even more that you can do. It's like, I don't even know. I feel like that's something that I still want to look into, where it's like, I'm not using things in to their full potential, I don't think, and I'd like to. And so, yeah, it's kind of just a constant learning, but also looking at things in a different way.
It's so key. It's always, I think, important to have people in any field who are just looking at it differently and showing everyone else, check this out. Because, yeah, probably nobody's ever going to deploy a client site that completely changes the layout at every breakpoint, but they might feel a little more free to change it in significant but useful ways, right? Yeah. Rather than just, oh, I'm going to make this a little more narrow and then I'm going to drop this down, but maybe do more. And so we need the visionaries, which I feel comfortable saying that you are one. You have visions for what you could do with a set of data, a set of trivia, a set of CSS commands, and do unexpected and interesting things with them. So if you won the lottery tomorrow, and therefore were able to just retire effectively, it's like, I don't have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. I'm set financially. What project would you do that you're not currently doing because of time constraints?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. I don't know if there's any that are like, that feel so like too big to accomplish where I would need all the time in the world, right? I think that a lot of them are still in kind of the, I'm not quite sure how this manifests stage yet. One thing I've been thinking about, I've been actually trying to figure out if there's a word for this, but in movies, so there's like this paradox that exists where like in Avengers Endgame, the Marvel movie, they talk about time travel movies and they say like hot tub time machine, right? But Sebastian Stan, who plays Bucky, is in Hot Tub Time Machine, right? And so there's this paradox where actors exist in a movie, or they are in a movie where their other movie gets named. So I've been thinking, I don't know if there's a term for that in like the movie industry, but I've been thinking about things like that, like this kind of like meta thing that happens in media. So that's one project I've been kind of like simmering on. I don't know if that'll end up being anything. I've also been thinking about these are like all movie related. So one is like sitcom relationships. Like, I guess the sitcom is really different now, so maybe this is a little bit smaller in scope, but like Seinfeld and Friends, like all the different like romantic pairings that happen in those shows. I feel like that's something I've been thinking about. And I've been thinking about like death tolls on shows like Grey's Anatomy, where like I feel like everyone would joke that just everyone dies on that show. So yeah. Oh, also, sorry, I'm not sure this is interesting, but another thing I've been thinking about is like in cartoon shows, I don't know if there's a term for this in the industry either, where, you know, how in cartoon shows like The Simpsons, like everything resets every episode, right? But there's like sometimes something happens where it never gets reset, right? So like in The Simpsons, like, I don't know if this is true, but at some point, like, Santa's Little Helper, like, dies, right? And doesn't come back, I think. And that's, like, some sort of, like, canon event. I don't know, where, like, the reality or resetting world changes. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Have you ever noticed that, like, I've noticed that this occurs more on, like, these Christmas episodes or, like, those special episodes that they do only once a year, when they have like this trope that only comes up maybe for Christmas episodes?
Yeah, I bet there is a pattern.
Yeah, I think canon event is probably the right term.
Yeah,
maybe that's okay. Because I just recently watched Across the Spider-Verse with my teen. So,
oh yeah,
where they talk about literally about canon events.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like there's probably a term for the other thing that you mentioned, where the somebody who's a character in one setting is a mentioned another one of my favorite examples of that is the J.J. Abrams Star Trek films. They keep using Beastie Boys songs.
Oh.
But in Intergalactic, there's a lyric about Mr. Spock.
Oh, yeah. That's totally.
So.
Right.
how does that work?
Yeah. But, yeah. It creates an interesting paradox or a multiverse or something.
Yeah. Anyway. So I think we're coming to the end. I mean, we could talk for hours, but tell people where they can find you and maybe pitch a little bit of support your way.
Yeah. So the best place to find me is lynandtonic.com, which is my website. I'm on Mastodon. I think it's lynandtonic at frontend.social. Probably not the best place to reach me. I think my website is probably the best spot. And you can jump to all my projects directly from there. And I encourage you to go take a look at them. I think you'll have a fun time with it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us for Gaia Chats, Lynn. Really appreciated it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.